Professor Perlmutter is someone probably that I really don't need to introduce because I imagine most of you know who he is, but he's the professor of the and the director of Miami's law school's Children and Youth Law Clinic, and he's litigated for on behalf of children for over 20 years and has been very active in class action and impact litigation that affects children in the dependency system and in the delinquency system. So he and his students this morning are going to talk to us about the administrative process, and they have done a PowerPoint for us that was sent out this morning. So if you have not yet pulled that up, please do so now so that you'll be ready to go. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Professor Perlmutter.
Hi, thank you, Mary Kay. And without too much of an introduction, I'm going to hand it over to two of the three students who work with me in preparing for the training this early afternoon. Caitlin Curry and Shayna Shom are here today. Seda Wood was going to be with us, but she has a sick child that she's caring for. So we sort of reallocated who's going to speak about what at the last minute, and Caitlin is going to do the first part of the training. And notwithstanding the fact that everybody is on mute, if you do have a question that can't hold or can't wait, we welcome questions during the course of the CLE. So you can chime in if you like. So we'll get started, I guess, now. I still hear some of the beeps coming on, but I guess Caitlin will take it from here.
Sure.
So, and let us know if you don't hear our voices. I'm moving the phone so it's close to both Caitlin and Shayna.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess, to everybody that's here with us today. As Professor Perlmutter said, my name is Caitlin Curry. I'm here with Shayna Shom. She and I are both certified legal interns with the University of Miami Children and Youth Law Clinic. You should turn now to the second page of the PowerPoint so that we can begin. The second page really just outlines the purpose of the training today. Our goal is really to provide a working knowledge of the basics of fair hearings as they apply to statutory entitlements, specifically for the financially needy. And as the slide indicates, these government benefits or public benefits are going to include things like Road to Independence, Medicaid, Medicaid waiver, food stamps, and cash assistance. We just want to mention that this is in no way, shape, or form an exhaustive review of all of the elements and variety of procedures that may apply specifically to different statutory entitlements in Florida. We're just trying to provide sort of a collective look at administrative fair hearings. And as Professor Perlmutter noted, if you do have any questions, please don't hesitate to sort of pop in and ask if they are pressing. We'll do our best to answer all questions, although we can wait till the end to do so. Okay, go ahead and turn with me to slide 3, which indicates the common law beginnings of what we deal with on a regular basis here at the Children and Youth Law Clinic of fair hearings. The quote that you see on the slide is excerpted from the case Goldberg v. Kelly. A little picture of Justice Brennan indicates the author of the opinion. The quote really sort of hits at the core of what the case was all about, that to cut off a welfare recipient in the face of brutal need without a prior hearing of some sort is unconscionable unless overwhelming considerations justify it. The background to the Goldberg case is really a collective action brought on behalf of New York City residents who were receiving benefits under the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program or under New York State's General Home Relief Program. The action challenged the termination of those benefits under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and as I mentioned, Justice Brennan ultimately wrote the opinion, and this was really sort of a landmark case because it was the first time the Supreme Court issued an opinion stating that public benefits, if they're going to be terminated, reduced in any way, that there ought to be some sort of procedural due process awarded to those recipients prior to the deprivation of those benefits. So that it really is sort of like the landmark case that was the analog to everything that we're going to be talking about today. Specifically noteworthy, the opinion classifies welfare benefits as statutory entitlements, which is how we're going to refer to them today, rather than simply benefits, and they treat them respectively differently than privileges. The court makes specific note of the fact that the individuals who are receiving these public benefits are in many ways reliant on those benefits. These are the financially needy that are very much so reliant on the benefits that they're receiving from the public, from the government, and therefore reducing them or terminating them does put those recipients in a particularly dangerous or precarious position. And so the court required a certain level of due process, specifically a statutory fair hearing that would provide the recipient with a full administrative review, including adequate notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard or a hearing. So that is effectively the common law analog to what we're going to be talking about today. You can go ahead and turn with me to slide number four. What you're going to see there is really the federal law codification of the Goldberg v. Kelly case. And what's really important to note about the federal law is that it is making the requirement of a fair hearing, it's wrapping it in with any of the otherwise existing federal statutes providing public benefits. As noted on the slide, specifically mentioned is the Social Security Act, which many of you may know does provide a certain level of public benefits. Through this regulation, the federal regulation, Goldberg v. Kelly is effectively codified. And as you can see, the regulation requires a hearing before the state agency, specifically the state agency that is integral to the denial of the public benefit, or an evidentiary hearing at the local level with a right to appeal. And that's important just because you're getting a sense for the meaningful opportunity to be heard, as was noted in the Goldberg case, and is here reinstated under a federal regulation. So that sort of gives the backdrop to how we get to where we are here in this hearing, in this conference on administrative hearings. So if you turn with me now to slide number five, we sort of have outlined the variety of state entitlements that are going to require fair hearings or are going to provide for fair hearings for any of the recipients who are denied or who have their benefits reduced. These are all state entitlements that are developed pursuant to federal statutes. So, for example, the Road to Independence statute, with which our clinic deals with on a regular basis, is in part enacted pursuant to the Chafee Act, and there is a certain amount of federal funding that is channeled to the state in order to implement the goals of the Chafee Act through the Road to Independence program. That's just an example of how it works from a federal to state level and why these requirements that are that were adapted initially on the federal level come into play on the state level. So as you can see, we have at issue Medicaid, Road to Independence, food stamps, temporary assistance for needy families, otherwise known as TANFs, and Medicaid waivers from agencies for persons with disabilities. It's important to note that the Medicaid waiver is sort of a new development coming from last year's congressional term in Florida. Med waiver cases had traditionally been handled by DOA, the Division of Appeal Hearings, and have recently been moved to the Office of Appeal Hearings under the Department of Children and Families. So that's going to be a little bit of a shift. It's going to shift not just the tribunal, but also the procedures that are at play in any type of litigation under those issues. So go ahead.
Maybe I'll just chime in very, very quickly. There is a sort of a rubric in addition to the federal law and the constitutional law rubric that Caitlin was speaking to that falls under the Florida Administrative Procedure Act, the Florida APA is codified in Chapter 120 of the Florida Statutes. Chapter 120, Section 57, Part 1, speaks to the right of any private citizen who has been adversely affected by agency action and desires to administratively appeal that action, the right to an administrative hearing. Many of those hearings, as Caitlin says, suggests, are presided over by the Division of Administrative Hearings, DOA. But for our kinds of cases, our clients, increasingly the department's Office of Appeal Hearings presides, is the tribunal that hears the appeal of our clients. And these hearing officers in these hearings are not, as a general rule, law school trained, unlike all of us on this call. They are lay employees of the Department of Children and Families with years of experience, hopefully, but they're not trained in substantive law or legal process or the rules of evidence. And so the fair hearing officers are the fact finders, as well as those who make conclusions of law about whether or not the administrative agency decision is correct. And a couple of other examples to add to the mix, the kinds of issues that they will also be required to review would include things that I think are of interest to the GAL program attorneys. For example, I adopt a child, a special needs child, and I seek an adoption subsidy to pursuant to federal and state law from the state of Florida, and my request is denied. Well, I have a right to, again, invoke this process of the administrative fair hearing and to contest the correctness or the error of the action by the agency in denying my adoption subsidy application or package. For clients, I know you guys have had a training on master trust in the past delivered by Deborah Schroth. If you have a client who has been denied a fee waiver, fee reduction request for a master trust disbursement from DCF, those clients who are getting SSI, the state is collecting their SSI, it's getting the full, essentially the full amount of their monthly SSI check, but the client wants a little bit more, so they apply for a fee waiver, a fee reduction, and that is rejected by the case management agency. They have a right to appeal that denial to the Office of Appeal Hearings, which is a division or a branch of the families. And so I'll just stop here and stop chiming and let Caitlin take over.
So that seems to sort of robustly look at the varieties of hearings that are the varieties of issues that are going to be presented before the Department of Children and Families, their Division of Appeal Hearings. If you turn with me to the sixth slide, you will see the address and contact information for the Office of Appeal Hearings. And much like other litigation matters, all correspondence, including notices of appearances, requests for continuances, and any other discovery requests, must be filed with the Office of Appeal Hearings just to document and put them on notice of any anything that's going to be filed. And it's also worth noting that the statutory entitlements may be regulated by different state agencies. For example, the good example to use would be the Agency for Persons with Disabilities that's actually going to be sort of regulating Medicaid waivers. However, as we mentioned, those are actually, any denial of a Med waiver is actually going to be heard, the hearings pertaining to that denial is actually going to be heard by the Office of Appeal Hearings, not part of the Agency for Persons with Disabilities, rather as part of Department of Children and Families. So note that sort of disparity. And then, Professor, I don't know if you have anything on...
Yeah, well, Medicaid, again, is under the bailiwick of another executive branch agency, namely the Agency for Healthcare Administration. Any contested factual or legal issues that concern a child's entitlement to Medicaid benefits, these can take many shapes and many forms, those are also under the jurisdiction, so to speak, of the Office of Appeal Hearings. So the appeal hearing officers, the lay officers who hear the evidence and issue orders, they are essentially directed to a sister agency, be it the APD or the ACCA agencies that are not exactly the same as the Department of Children and Families. And I wanted to also note that there is a, while most administrative appeals are conducted by the Division of Administrative Hearings pursuant to Chapter 12057, subsection 1, there is a special carve-out in Chapter 120. It's in Chapter 12080, subsection 80, that delegates to the Department of Children and Families, subsection 7, a subset of adjudicatory hearings that specifically concern social and economic programs that were at one time administered by, and this predates even me, I've been doing this for 20 years, the Division of Family Services, which was a branch of the Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services. So there's a little bit of sort of background to how it is that there is an Office of Appeal Hearings, and the hearings that are delegated specifically, that subset of economic and social programs that are heard, that's pursuant to Chapter 120, subsection 7. Okay.
I think that pretty much covers the that slide. Let's turn now to slide number 7, requesting a fair hearing. As the slide indicates, a request for a fair hearing can be made either verbally or in writing, and it's important to note that many times the fair hearing request will take place without the knowledge or assistance of counsel. Oftentimes in our office, we don't do an intake for a client until after they had already been denied the public benefit and then made the request for fair hearing without any of our involvement whatsoever. The likely scenario would be an individual going to the office of whatever agency that provides the statutory entitlement, be it a food stamp office or their case management agency if it's an RTI check in question, they go to pick up their check. And that day they're informed of their denial. There's no check for them waiting. And at that very moment, they, under the instruction of whoever is at the office, they request an appeal in the form of a fair hearing. And so as the slide indicates on the bottom portion, if that is not the scenario, the individual denied a public benefit will have 30 days to take appeal from the decision, and it's also important to know if the appeal is timely, as noted in the middle of the slide, within 10 days of the denial, the individual is more than likely to be entitled to continue receiving the public benefit until the issue is actually fully heard and adjudicated on by the hearing officer. So that's something important to note if you have an ongoing lawyer-client relationship and the client indicates that he or she has been denied whatever public benefit is at issue, it's important to encourage them or counsel them to file or request the fair hearing as soon as possible so that if, in the best case scenario, they can maintain that benefit during the process of preparation before the hearing, or in the worst case scenario, at least preserve the opportunity to have the hearing.
And I just want to interject. We have a case currently in our clinic of a client who was notified that his benefits were going to be reduced or terminated, but there was a little bit of shakeup going on here in our region of the state. There may be some folks who are South Florida people, and one of our case management agencies, has recently been shut down. So our poor client gets the notice. And he tries to invoke the 10-day appeal rule, but nobody is around at the agency, this case management agency, to receive his timely request to keep his to appeal this decision and to give him the aid pending the appeal. So we've written a letter to our kids asking that they consider his appeal timely, essentially toll the 10 days, and we're waiting for a call back from our kids it was really not of his own making. It's clearly the sort of the bureaucratic mess up that he was sort of the victim of when One Hope United shut down and he didn't have anybody to respond to and to request his fair hearing within the 10 days. He was clearly within the 30 calendar days, but he was not technically within the 10 days of the notice of case action that would allow him to receive aid pending the appeal. So these are the kinds of issues that will arise from time to time.
An extreme case, but worth noting nonetheless. You can go ahead and turn now to slide number 8 regarding pre-hearing fact-finding and settlement negotiation. Within the agency, there is a requirement that an agency supervisor review the action under appeal prior to the appeal actually being heard in front of a hearing officer. And I think that our office has found that particularly useful. I can remember a case of my own where we took the opportunity to request review by a supervisor within the agency and collectively joined around a conference table to talk about the case that was potentially going to go up on appeal, and it was very useful both in the opportunity for settlement, although we did not actually achieve settlement at that conference table at that time. It was also a good opportunity to flesh out further the facts that perhaps were not properly indicated in the record or that we did not all have a mutual understanding of. And that was, you know, that was particularly helpful for that case, just to get a better understanding and have really all of the important players at the same table to talk about the case. So it served both a potential settlement negotiation. It served as a potential settlement negotiation opportunity, as well as a pretty effective fact-finding experience. So you can see that in the lower portions of the slide that, if possible, the supervisory review could lead to resolution of the denial or the issue pursuant to the denial without a hearing, which obviously is cost-effective and more efficient. So it's sort of commonsensical that it's put into practice in terms of fair hearings. So there is the opportunity for settlement as in other types of litigation. However, it's important to note that if settlement does occur prior to the hearing, the petitioner must withdraw the appeal. Otherwise, it's still pending, and it doesn't look good for the agencies to have the pending appeal despite settlement. So it is important that the petitioner who filed or made the request for fair hearing withdraw that request if settlement is, in fact, reached. Go ahead now and turn to slide number 9. Preparation for the hearing. So as you can see, there's a number of things that need to be done prior to the hearing, not the least of which is determining the specific policy that's relied upon by the department and or agency in making the decision at issue. That's important because you want to make sure you have, the agency or department is required to give reasons for the denial. They can't just deny it in an ad hoc fashion. There must be a reason there. So it's important to note it for that reason, and it's also important to note that to determine what documentation they're providing you relevant to that denial and making sure that documentation, in fact, does support that reason for denial rather than some other reason that's not actually stated. Speaking of documentation, it's important to acquire all the documentation relied on by the department in making the decision. In our office, we refer to that documentation as the denial packet, and that is something that the whoever opposing counsel is, in our case, typically the Attorney General's office, is required to provide. They need to give the denial packet. Otherwise, it's impossible to formulate any type of argument for why the petitioner is entitled to whatever benefit they were denied, because you have no understanding of why, in fact, they were denied.
Let me just sort of chime in. At this juncture, we have on one of the later slides a reference to sort of the discovery process in this preparation phase for these hearings. And indeed, the administrative rules that are in play in these hearings make specific, as does Chapter 120, make reference to the Florida Rules of Civil Procedure, Rules of Discovery. And so you can utilize the full panoply of discovery, civil discovery rules that are available to you before a judicial tribunal in preparing and getting evidence adverse to your client, or perhaps helpful to your client from the department or the agency that you are litigating against in these hearings. And so we routinely submit more or less routine requests for discovery. When we started to do these fear hearings, we were really sort of over the top in spelling out every type of discoverable item that we were seeking. Usually there's no contest over, you know, privilege or other things that are normally part and parcel of the civil discovery process in the court system, in the civil court arena. But it's important to get all of the evidence, the independent living packet, among other types of evidence that may be in the custody of the department.
Sort of stemming from what Professor Perlmutter just noted, not just the denial packet is relevant. All relevant documentation is not necessarily in. Is that a question? No.
Maybe a cough.
Oh, sorry. In the denial packet. For example, we have a client that we just brought in through our intake process, who was denied in August for reasons, you know, not attending school to meet the statutory requirements for road to independence benefits. He's denied in August and then returns to school the day that he's denied in an effort to comply, in a good faith effort to comply with the statutory requirements, and has been attending school since August. The hearing is not for another 2 weeks, and the relevant documents would include stuff that's not in the denial packet, namely the attendance records and any other records from the school regarding his performance in school from August until November. But that's not in the denial packet, so it's just sort of to emphasize the point that the relevant documentation may not necessarily be in the denial packet, which is why the discovery requests that Professor Perlmutter was talking about are relevant, as well as your own fact-finding off of your client. Another note to make is that it's important to know the burden of proof at the hearing and who bears that burden. It's going to depend on what type of public benefit it is and whether it's a denial or a reduction, and that's something that can be specifically found in some of our reference direction at the end of, and it's sort of more specific.
There's a series of published Florida administrative rules that are pertinent to a variety of government assistance fair hearings, and there's a specific rule that speaks to burden of proof. And the general rule of thumb is that if the individual, if your client is challenging a denial of an application for or request for a specific type of benefit, then they have the burden of showing that they were erroneously denied this benefit. But if they were receiving the benefit and the department or the agency is reducing or terminating the benefit, then the burden is on the department to show that the action was correct. So it's a very, very simple proposition as to burden of proof. And the standard of proof, by the way, is, as in all civil proceedings, preponderance of the evidence.
So in addition to, stemming off of what I was mentioning about the client that we have with this lengthy period of time passing, and he's now re-enrolled in school, and we have new school documents. As the slide indicates, those documents, we will have to share those documents within 7 days of the hearing if we're going to use them in evidence. That's sort of the general rule, and vice versa. If the attorney general, the assistant attorney general that we are working on this case with, finds any documents that he's going to use in evidence on the date of the hearing, he's going to need to submit them to us within 7 days of the date of the hearing. That's just sort of a procedural, make sure everybody has all of the evidence with enough time to review it before the hearing. And sort of a cautionary word, any delay in sharing the evidence could result in the hearing officer reconvening the hearing at a later time, which could potentially be detrimental to the client. So it is important to make sure that all that evidence is fully and fairly disclosed to opposing counsel.
And one footnote to that is it could be, if the department doesn't timely disclose the evidence that it's going to be relying upon 7 days hence at the hearing, then you can actually object to its submission as evidence, and that's what we did in a recent fair hearing for RTI benefits that one of our other students handled a couple of weeks ago. So helpful information to the department, but adverse information to our client, arguably adverse information to our client, was excluded from the record, and so you can make the most of that as well in your zealous advocacy for your client's interests.
Good point to note. Turning to slide number 10 for notice of hearing, the baseline is that the notice of hearing will be issued 14 days before the hearing. However, oftentimes clients are aware of the hearing with more than 14 days to spare. However, 14 days before the hearing can produce a time crunch, so it is important to stay on top of those deadlines. And as the slide indicates, the hearing is going to include the time, place, and location of the hearing. An interesting note, some of the hearings can be held telephonically instead of a physical location. They're also held at a physical location, but some of these hearings are now being conducted with the hearing officer sitting in Tallahassee, the client with or without counsel, somewhere in South Florida, and the attorney general or the assistant attorney general in their office in Fort Lauderdale or wherever else. And and that is an interesting situation, which requires that all of the evidence that is going to be used, you need to make sure that everyone that's going to be attending the hearing telephonically has all physical copies of that evidence in order to have a full and fair hearing.
Just a footnote to that point. Typically, as a rule, in order to accommodate the client's ability to be present at the hearing, the hearing is scheduled in a location which is closest to the client. So the Tallahassee hearing that Caitlin is referring to, a client of ours who was a student at FSU but a Miami kid, had the fair hearing occurring before a hearing officer in Tallahassee. And we were in Miami. Typically it's based upon sort of a catchment area concept. So we have three fair hearing officers in our region right now, and they schedule the hearing at the area, the DCF office, which is closest to where the client resides. For clients who have physical disabilities, there's another specific rule that is designed to provide them reasonable accommodations under the ADA so that they can access, be transported if necessary to the hearing at department expense to the hearing to accommodate their disability.
And something worth noting, I'm not sure if this is a new policy, but we were actually asked to do an entire telephonic hearing despite the fact that our client resides here, we are here, the assistant attorney general is also here, but the hearing officer herself is in Tallahassee. And so the Department of Children and Families has hired a number of new hearing officers, and many of them are in Tallahassee, and so the need for a telephonic hearing or sort of the popularity of the telephonic hearing is becoming more widespread, I think. That seems to be the direction that the Office of Appeal Hearings is turning at this time. That's, of course, subject to change. So go ahead and turn to slide 11, motions for continuances. The general rule is really that either party can request a continuance for good cause, and that's fairly straightforward. The any other continuances after the first continuance is granted is only going to be granted in emergency circumstances, and that's pretty standard across the board. However, we have just been made aware of the new rule, and I have it somewhere here. There is a new rule on continuances that is in the Administrative Rule 65C. And that indicates the new rule. The new rule, as listed on the slide, is that it must be 7 days before the date of the hearing that you request a continuance for good cause in RTI appeals. So they're adding an additional requirement specifically for RTI appeals that has sort of put a crunch on some of the clients who are not aware that they need to seek counsel or not advised of the 7-day rule and end up looking for counsel within the 7-day period before their hearing, and it's something to be aware of, because if you have a client approaching you needing counsel for a hearing within that period, the Office of Appeal Hearings is being a little bit lenient now because the rule, its implementation is fairly recent. However, I can see going forward them becoming a little bit more staunch about enforcing the rule. So it's definitely something to take note of. As the bottom of the slide indicates, the food stamp program allows for numerous continuances. So that's just something to sort of file away. And with the end of slide number 11, I'm going to turn it over to Shayna.
Great, thank you. We're going to start talking about attending the hearing, and I just wanted to reference Berg v. Kelly, which Caitlin spoke about at the beginning, where the court says that these hearings don't need to take the form of a judicial or quasi-judicial trial. So accordingly, the fair hearings are often somewhat informal, and so what you can expect if you've never been to one of these hearings before is that the general setup of the room, it's going to be pretty small and intimate. You might be sitting at a large table where all of the parties are together and the hearing officer is sitting there too. If you have arranged to have witnesses appear by phone, you must also make arrangements for them to be sworn in by a notary public. And subsequent to the hearing, the witness appearing telephonically must also execute an affidavit of identity that will be submitted to the hearing officer to verify that the witness is who they're claiming. And as Caitlin said, you just want to make sure that the witness and everybody has a copy of all the evidentiary documents. Moving on to the next slide. So as I said, the hearings can be somewhat informal, and it's at the discretion of the hearing officer to choose to follow or not follow the order of the hearing rigidly. But we have the whole formal order here for you, and I'm just going to read through it. There'll be an introduction by the hearing officer, followed by opening statements. Then there'll be an evidentiary presentation by both parties according to who has the burden of proof, which Professor Perlmutter talked about earlier. Just to give you an example with RTI, if your client was previously receiving the RTI checks, the scholarship, and the hearing is due to a reduction or termination of those RTI checks, the department has the burden of proof. On the other hand, if you're appealing the initial denial of benefits, so an RTI, if your client was previously not receiving any RTI benefits and was denied an initial application, then you'll have the burden of proof. That's followed by a rebuttal of evidence presented respectively by both parties, closing statements or a motion for a proposed order, and final closing instructions from the hearing officer. And slide. During the hearing, witnesses should be testifying to the actions they take or they have taken, or those of which they have personal knowledge. As we said, again, witnesses can appear telephonically, and the documents relied on in the decision made by the evidence.
Just sort of footnote to the telephonic appearances, it's a useful tool if you have a witness who has personal knowledge that's helpful to your client. In one of these cases, it could be a doctor. It could be a case that Caitlin handled last year. We had our client's guardian ad litem, who was an attorney in Miami, in downtown Miami. It wasn't convenient for him to go to the Joseph Caleb Center in central Miami-Dade. So we made prior arrangements for his former GAL, or his current, actually, it was still his current GAL, to testify telephonically. So it allows busy people who are going to be able to provide useful, corroborating testimony to appear telephonically. However, you do need, as Shayna said, to submit post-hearing an affidavit executed by the witness and before a notary public that they are who they say they are.
And just another example for a case that I worked on that ended up, for an RTI appeal that ended up getting settled, prior to the fair hearing, we did arrange for a school advisor to speak telephonically at the hearing to attest to the student's attendance record. So that's another example. Move on to the next slide. Something relevant to point out about these hearings is the hearsay rules. Hearsay evidence may be used to supplement or explain other evidence, but it can't be used to make a finding of fact in and of itself. And to the extent that the rules of discovery in the Florida Rules of Civil Procedure are not inconsistent with Chapter 120, the rules of discovery of the Florida Rules of Civil Procedure shall be applicable.
And just as a note, that particular bullet point probably should have been put in an earlier slide, but just to emphasize what we were saying earlier, you know, if you're not getting discovery in a timely manner, you can engage in the motion practice that those of you who have worked in the civil court system in the arena involving civil litigation are very familiar with. You can seek to compel discovery and take a variety of other steps to ensure timely disclosure of information, and you can make full use of the rules of civil procedure.
So we'll move on to the next slide, which is failing to appear. If the petitioner authorized representative fails to appear without good cause, the appeal will be dismissed. We're giving you a definition of good cause here. It's defined as a substantial reason put forth in good faith that is not unreasonable, arbitrary, or irrational, and that is sufficient to create an excuse for an act. However, if the department fails to appear, the appeal may be granted or sanctions may be placed against the department if another date must be set for the hearing. Okay, post-hearing submittals, the next slide. Either party may request that the hearing officer leave the record open for submissions of additional evidence, memoranda of law, or proposed orders, and each request will be considered on its facts.
And we routinely, in all of the cases that we've handled a fairly wide variety of public benefits issues before hearing officers, both because it's a good sort of teaching kind of exercise or learning exercise for our students, but also because it highly benefits our client in terms of creating a full record that fully reflects the position that our client is taking, both factually and legally. We routinely prepare proposed final or proposed recommended orders that we allow us to sort of have another sort of closing statement, as it were, and the hearing officers are always very willing to, because they have to, grant us a leave for at least an additional 14 or sometimes even more days to submit a proposed order. That allows you, effectively, it functions as a trial memo, and it allows you to sort of try to influence the hearing officer in terms of the fact-finding and legal conclusion requirements that they are bound by as hearing officers.
The one thing I would note in dealing with the new rule for continuances, if any of you are dealing with the RTI statute and are frustrated by the new 7-day rule and the fact that many of the recipients are not particularly aware of such a rule, moving to leave the record open for submissions of additional evidence in the event that you cannot get a continuance and don't have the opportunity to fully flesh out all the documents. One of our other attorneys here made the recommendation that it may be a good idea to move to leave the record open such that if any other records come up, any documentation that you requested from outside sources that you haven't yet received could be potentially submitted to the hearing officer for consideration given the circumstances of the continuance. So it may be strategically a good idea to move to leave the record open in the event that the continuance issue comes up.
It also is helpful when you have an unavailable witness. So, for example, we've had some cases where a key and critical witness was not available on the date of the hearing. On an oral motion, we've requested leave to submit an affidavit by that witness. As I recall, at least in a couple of cases, it involved school officials with testimony that they were otherwise going to deliver telephonically or in person. We couldn't get them on the date of the hearing. The hearing officer, sometimes over the objection of the department's counsel from the Attorney General's office, sometimes when they stipulate to it, has allowed us the opportunity to submit witness affidavits post-hearing.
Right, so those are all great points that transition us into the next slide, which is about the final order, which we've now talked about a little bit. But the hearing officer is going to issue a final order that will basically state the facts and the legal authority they're relying on to make their decision. And the deadline for most of the programs is 90 days 90 days from the date of the hearing request, but we wanted also to note that the food stamp program deadline is 60 days. The next slide is judicial review, if petitioner loses the hearing, they have the right to judicial review in the Florida District Court of Appeal within 30 days of the order. It's important to note that the petitioner may file a fee waiver to waive the court fees upon seeking judicial review, but they must do so in a timely manner. I also wanted to mention that since DCF officers preside over non-DCF issues such as food stamps appeals, decisions are considered recommended orders. And the department cannot request an appeal. The final order is a final decision for the department.
Yeah, there are just to flesh out these two points. Obviously, the first point is one that those of you who have some experience in the appellate arena are aware. You have 30 days to file your notice of appeal from the rendering of the appealable order by the lower court tribunal. The action that that we were speaking about in this presentation concerns the Office of Appeal Hearings as an administrative tribunal under the bailiwick, I guess you could say, of the Department of Children and Families. Similarly, some matters, as we were saying earlier, are delegated to the Division of Administrative Hearings. Now, some of those kinds of issues, like the APD appeals, are going to once again be heard by hearing officers. Well, you do, if you think that you have an appealable issue, you can take it up. And you have a sort of a choice of forum. You can appeal to the District Court of Appeal where your client resides. So obviously for us, that's the third DCA. But since the Department of Children and Families is headquartered, so to speak, in Tallahassee, you also have the alternative of appealing final orders to the first DCA, and there are some advantages and some disadvantages of going to one or the other. We've appealed cases, final orders of cases that we've lost to both the third DCA and the first DCA. I'm sorry to report that we've lost the appeals that we've filed in the past. One was a per curiam affirmance. The other one was just a very short affirmance of the hearing officer's final order. We have currently pending an issue that is before the first DCA. We felt that the first DCA, sort of like the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, has the kind of expertise that we would hope that they could bring to bear on an administrative law issue involving a claim for a reasonable accommodation that our client raised at the fair hearing under the ADA, disability statute, federal disability law. So, you do have that choice of forum. And as Shana pointed out, if the department loses, they cannot seek further review. It is binding upon them. However, there is a certain subset of cases involving non-department issues that fall under the rubric of recommended orders. So among the kinds of issues that are under that rubric are decisions concerning a client's eligibility for APD benefits, for example, or a specific type of service that the client is seeking under the Medicaid laws. And in those instances, the hearing officers are issuing recommended orders. If the recommended order is favorable to your client, it still has to be reviewed by the agency head, the secretary of the Agency for Persons with Disabilities, the secretary of the Agency for Healthcare Administration. So even if you do prevail at the fair hearing, it is subject to further review and is not automatically binding upon that particular agency until the time that the secretary, the high, the chief kuba of that office, decides to grant or to deny the request. And there is also a right to file exceptions to final or recommended orders. So clearly, if you prevail and the final order is favorable to you, you're not going to file exceptions. But in those instances where there is a recommended order issued, then you do have a right to file factual and legal exceptions in a timely manner.
So let's move on to the next slide, which is implementation. The final order must be implemented no later than 10 days from the date of the final order. So that means that if the hearing officer finds, for example, that the petitioner's RTI award funds were improperly reduced, the proper award amount must be reinstated within those 10 days following the issuance of the final order. And upon a notice of appeal or a petition for judicial review of the final order, it's important to note that the filing of the petition does not by itself stay the enforcement of the agency decision. So to use another the example of RTI again, upon appeal of an RTI denial, the petitioner will continue to receive their original monthly award until the date of the hearing. However, if the final order issued pursuant to the fair hearing finds in favor of the department and your client chooses to petition for judicial review, your client will not continue to receive their original RTI award checks while awaiting the review. So that concludes the substantive portion of our PowerPoint. We have two more slides which have information, additional information about fair hearings, and a slide with our contact information. And at this point, we'd just like to open it up for any questions that you might have.
We do hope that the GAL program attorneys and any AALs who are on the call will look to the administrative appeal process as an important area for your clients. I know that most of your time is spent advocating for the best interests or the legal interests of your clients in the juvenile court, but you have to keep in mind that there are a lot of issues that juvenile circuit judges don't have subject matter jurisdiction over. We haven't even talked about school issues. I know you've had at least one training in the recent past delivered by Jerry Glynn of Barry Law School about that advocacy. But there are many issues, that cannot be adjudicated by our judges and that have to be taken up through the administrative fair hearing appeal process. And ultimately, if you seek further judicial review, that's only available if you petition in a timely manner to the district courts of appeal in our state. So keep in mind that there are a lot of interests of your clients that are within the purview of this process that we've been describing, and that are outside of the purview of the circuit court.
I have a question.
Sure.
This is Wanda Davis in the Sixth Circuit. Are there any provisions for waiver of costs for discovery or subpoenas?
Good question. I think I don't know absolutely the answer, but by definition, our clients are all indigent, and I think they would automatically be eligible. You may have to jump through some hoops, but as Shana was saying, when you are filing your notice of appeal to the district court, in order for that to be perfect that appeal, you have to do the indigency. I've never seen a case of ours where a client hasn't been found indigent. So I think the agency clerk at the Office of Appeal Hearings would probably be in a position to declare your client indigent for purposes of exactly what you're asking about.
Okay.
Professor?
Yes.
Hi, Susan King in the Fifth Circuit. Have you ever dealt with any appeals involving denial of an adoption?
Denial of an adoption. Amazingly, no. and I don't know if those would be subject to this particular process. I think those would most likely be subject to district court review automatically after because that's within the purview of the circuit court. The adoption subsidy, however, is another matter. That's an agency decision.
Okay, and then with regard to the appeals that you have handled, what would you say the time frame was from the filing of the notice of appeal, first for the administrative judge's decision and second for the DCA decision?
They can go on and on and on, but the new the time frames are getting tighter and tighter, so Caitlin and Shana could probably answer that as well as I. I mean, when the client submits their request for the fair hearing, they can have their hearing scheduled, outside of Dade County for sure, fairly quickly, and you should be prepared and ready to go. There is a requirement in the rules that the notice of the hearing be sent out 14 days in advance of the hearing. So at least you would have a fortnight to get ready. And as far as the DCA process, that's subject to a variety of other factors like continuances and delays in perfecting the record on appeal or perfecting the appeal itself. So the case that we have currently before the first DCA, the hearing is here. We are in November. The hearing took place in February, and we still have an unresolved, unsettled issue. We're hoping to actually settle the case out of court, but we still are forging ahead with our appeal.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Charlie Barber from the Sixth Judicial Circuit, and I have a related question. Has the Florida legislature provided funding for children who are placed in court-approved dependency guardianships after the age of 16?
To my knowledge, they haven't, and this is one of
they
those.
They haven't.
Okay. This is one of those developments that is fast breaking. The notion we're doing some research here. One of our judges asked us to do some research here on this. I think what you're referring to is sort of the subsidized guardianship permanency goal that seems to be coming up increasingly in a lot of these cases, and it's sort of an outgrowth of the changes in federal law to the Chafee Act. That occurred in 2008 or 2009 that authorized states to make guardianship an acceptable goal. But to my knowledge, we haven't tapped into the TANF program that allows us to draw down the federal dollars to be able to subsidize these guardianships.
Okay.
So a lot of caregivers, non-licensed caregivers, are going to be caring for children as guardians. Of course, then the kids are going to lose out. They may not qualify for RTI. That's
right, and that's the concern because now they're 18, 19, and they need help, and they don't have the finances.
Right. Yeah, so there are, I don't think the state has really, the DCF has really fully thought this out and thought about all the direct and collateral consequences of this change in policy.
Okay, thank you.
No. Any other questions or...
Okay, if there's no other questions, why don't we go ahead and wrap it up, and thank you so much for your time and for presenting to us today.
Yeah, and I really want to thank Caitlin and Shayna, and I'm sorry that Seda couldn't participate in today's call, taking care of her. But
yes,
we enjoyed the presentation to you all.
Thank you.